is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to this week's Big Picture, and we have subtitled it, Let's Hassle Jim, otherwise known as On the Record, where we get to ask him all sorts of questions from based on emails that people send us. We sort of try to summarize them in a way that they can be summarized. We have to put them together so people can understand them. All right. So we got a whole pile of questions here. Let's proceed with them. And that will be the big picture for today. Now, if you've been listening to the program, I'm sure you know that recently Jim has become more cautious on both the economy and the markets. This was after a long period where we were rather bullish on the opportunities in the market when everybody else was screaming and shouting, she's going to blow, she's going to blow. And it never blew, by the way. You should make a note of that. Note to self, note number 75. People yelling and screaming, sky is falling, sky did not fall, period. Remember this in the future, okay? What caused the shift in your view? Where do you think we're headed? We seem to have gone over the top of a hill and headed somewhere else.
Well, you know, the thing that makes this, what we think, the next downturn a little bit different than what we've experienced probably in the last two downturns is, John, there's not anything that could point to bubble-like characteristics in the economy. I mean, if you go back to, let's say, the 90s, you know, the tech bubble, when you had companies that were going public and became worth billions of dollars with no sales or profits, and things just really got distorted to extreme, and especially when you look at PE ratios, something that Dan Wojtowski talked about in hour one today. And then, of course, the last downturn, the Great Recession, we had real estate prices that were just absolutely absurd. There aren't a lot of extremes. Are stocks cheap today? No. Are they overvalued? Somewhat, but you can't say they're, you know, in bubble-like territory. What I think you're seeing here, at least this is our opinion, is we've been in this sort of debt cycle, as the bank credit analysts have called it, the end of the debt super cycle, where you have a tremendous amount of leverage that was out there as a result of the run-up in debt in the last decade. And part of that is accounted for some of the weak economic growth. But what we've had basically since this recovery, it's really been a monetary driven recovery because fiscal policy has been a disaster and it's getting even worse with the flurry of new regulations that the Obama administration wants to put into effect in the president's last year of office. So, you know, fiscal policy has been anti-growth and that has put a limit in terms of what the Fed has been able to do with monetary policy. But let's face it, without the low interest rate environment that we've been operating under over the last 7 or 8 years, it's doubtful that we would have had the economic recovery, albeit as anemic as it has been, we wouldn't have had one at all. So what we're looking at now are sort of the more subtle type things that we're seeing in the economy. As everybody knows, we talk a lot about the LEIs here, and we're following them, and they're sort of a mixed picture. They're not all rolling over. Some are ticking up, not by much, and they're mixed. So what we're looking for are the more subtle clues that we're starting to see out there. We've talked in previous shows where we're following the unemployment report. An example, last Friday's unemployment numbers, everybody hailed them as, gee, this is really great. A lot more jobs were created. But if you notice, the number of jobs being created is starting to fall. And then if you dive into the weeds in the unemployment report, there's all kinds of things there that are showing that things are beginning to weaken. Whether it is the number of hours worked, if it's the number of temp employment, and if you look at things like especially the youth unemployment, something that Greg Weldon and I didn't get a chance to talk about in hour one, but the unemployment among youth is really alarming. In fact, what we've seen is a decline in average hourly earnings, a slight uptick in the unemployment rate last Friday, and a drop in hiring plans all contributed to another lackluster report. And, you know, this is something that we're starting to see that we're getting more evidence, whether it's the buildup in inventories. Look, when inventories start to build, the great thing about that is that adds to GDP growth. But unless that inventory is cleared out of the warehouse, in other words, sales come in and absorb that inventory, what happens? Eventually, manufacturers start to pull back on their production. So we're seeing a number of things, very subtle at this level, but it's telling us that from our perspective, John, we think, for example, corporate profits have peaked, and that happened in the summer of 2014. And when corporate profits peak, eventually what happens? And this is what we're seeing reflected in the unemployment report. Companies start reducing their temporary employment. That's the easiest to go. They start reducing the work week, and then eventually they start laying off workers. And now the jump up in the unemployment rate last week was due to a participation rate increasing. But we're seeing a number of things out there that are telling us that corporate profits have peaked and we think economic growth has peaked. And when you head into a recession, it isn't something that all of a sudden everything's going along and then 1 month later, you're in a recession. It's a process, just like market tops are a process. And we think that's the process that we're going through now. And we're seeing it in all these little nuances from whether you look at labor, whether you look at inventories, whether you look at corporate profits. All those things are telling us that we're heading into a slowdown. And then worse is we're getting a whole slew of new regulations that are going to make it even more difficult and more anti-business that are coming out of the Obama administration in his final year in office. So all of these things are putting a damper on the economy. And without effective fiscal policy, John, as Greg and I talked about in the first hour, we're finally reaching the limits of monetary effectiveness. In other words, for every type of monetary maneuver now, there is less and less effectiveness in terms of its ability to stimulate markets or, more importantly, to stimulate the economy. So, you know, we have turned more cautious and we've been getting defensive since last fall, and I think for very good reason. I mean, if you don't have corporate profits rising, if you have them falling, if sales are starting to decline, it was amazing because there was a study done by bank credit analysts of all the sectors that make up the S&P. In 2/3 of the sectors, the companies in those sectors had difficulty raising prices. And what that means is we're heading more into a very difficult economic environment when companies cannot raise prices to recoup cost. And so what that means is you're seeing margins compress. And when margins compress, that means corporate profits compress. And when that happens, companies start taking steps to protect those profits. And one of the first signs that you see that reflected is in production levels and also the labor market. And John, we're seeing right now, everybody's talking about the headline numbers, but if you start diving into the weeds and looking into the particulars of the report, they already indicate that this economy has begun its slowdown. And I expect as we head into the summer that a lot of these numbers are going to begin to look even worse. And especially with all of the political anger that you see in this country as a result of basically monetary and government policy right now. A lot of people are hurting. A lot of people aren't making the money they used to. A lot of people have lost their jobs or have gotten back into the job market with jobs that, let's say, pay less. I mean, you look at the unemployment numbers that were released Friday and the jobs, we lost 29,000 manufacturing jobs. These are high paying jobs, and we got a whole bunch of jobs in the service sector, which are lower paying jobs. So there's a good reason why we have shifted to a more cautious stance, because we think sometime by next year that we could be in a recession. There's a high probability. Our PFS group recession indicator is at 15. It got to close to 20 in 2011 before the Fed launched QE2. And of course, we remember all the geopolitical and economic events that occurred in that year. But our recession indicator is starting to rise, John, and that puts us on a cautious stance.
Yeah, that's true. And it's important to remember that bull markets don't go straight up, bear markets don't go straight down. It's a stepped process, like you say. There are certain things that happen en route, which sometimes, by the way, makes it hard for people to figure out what's going on unless you know how to read the indicators. Okay, next question. You were an early proponent of investing in gold in the first decade of the new century. Remember, we talked about it a lot starting back in, where was it, 2001, 2002?
Actually, when we first started doing the program together was, what was that, John? 2001?
2001, as I recall, we started doing the first stuff. So, and you were right. And everybody then was just calling this, you know, a temporary bubble. It wasn't anything. And it was a strong bull market in gold, and the gold crazies went crazy. How's that? And they were saying this was great. And then I remember when you called for a halt that was over. Boy, did you catch flack on that one. And for the last few years, you've not been in favor of gold, but recently now you've shifted position again, and you seem to like, or at least considering, some investment in gold. Is this a major shift in position, or is it just monitoring what the real world is doing out there and reacting accordingly, you know, or something along that line? So why the shift?
Well, I think we're moving into a more favorable environment for gold, especially with negative interest rates. And I think what the gold market, at least in my opinion, if you take a look at when gold took off in February, there were two events that happened. One was the Bank of Japan announced negative interest rates. So now you have, you know, the four largest economies in the world, the European economy and Japan, have policies of negative interest rates. And then that was followed up by, I think it was the following week, when Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill, and the subject of negative interest rates was brought up. And they said, well, it's something we've looked at. We're not looking at it right now, but it's something we've been looking into. So there are a number of reasons why I think the backdrop for gold is, I think the gold market is sniffing sort of the end game that is beginning here with central banks. I mean, there is a limitation in terms of what central banks can do, and they're running out of bullets. Now, as Greg and I talked about in the first hour, there are a number of things that they can do that can surprise all of us and keep this game going for a much longer period of time. So I think right now, economic conditions are becoming more favorable, because what are countries doing? They're relying on policies to debase their currency with the idea of trying to gain additional trade benefits by selling to somebody else at a cheaper currency. Your goods become cheaper. And even the Fed, in its own policies, saw what happened with the dollar rising as it did in the summer of 2014, what it did to corporate profits, what it's done to economic growth, and what it's done to the stock market. When you think about it, since the summer of 2014 and in the fall of 2014, the markets have had a very difficult time here with the ending of taper and the peak of corporate profits, but also the rise in the dollar. And being the world's reserve currency, a rising dollar can wreak havoc in the rest of the world, especially the emerging market, as many countries, for example, China, has had to defend its own currency with a rundown of its reserves from nearly $4 trillion down to $3.2 trillion. Saudi Arabia running down their reserves by almost $100 billion. So I think, John, the backdrop for gold once again is turning favorable. And I think also there's less gold available because you have China, which has been building its gold reserves. Of course, we don't have access to exactly how large their gold reserves are. Some think that they're up to 2,000 tons of gold. They not only basically absorb all their own input of gold production in their country, but they're also going on into the open market. So as Jim Rickards and I covered when we discussed his book, The New Case for Gold, last week, we talked about there's probably less and less gold available because a lot of that gold is going to sovereign countries like China. It's going to central banks and large institutions. And much of what happens in the gold market on a daily basis is the gold paper market. But we know that there would be real difficulty if there ever was a time when people that were in gold paper demanded gold instead and find out they really can't get the stuff. So I think, John, we're entering a period of time where the backdrop for gold is going to become more favorable going forward. And once again, I think it reflects a couple of things, something that Martin Armstrong and I talked about last October, which is a growing loss of confidence in government. And you're seeing that play out in this year's presidential election, where it seems like you know, the establishment candidates, and you really saw this more so on the Republican side because, you know, Hillary Clinton is the establishment candidate on the Democrat side, but we had 17 candidates on the Republican side at one time. Many of them were accomplished governors that achieved great economic success, and they were quickly dissed by Donald Trump. So the anti-establishment candidates seem to be what people are going for. And I don't know about your view, John, but it's really, at least in my lifetime, I've never seen a political campaign as the one we're seeing now.
Yeah, you look at it and you say, well, there really aren't any good candidates. And if you look at the items that are rushing towards us, which are, I think, number one, a rapidly changing geopolitical stability situation. We won't go into that right here. But number two, it's obvious we're headed towards future financial crises, especially at the central bank level. And then you look at what these people are proposing or not dealing with in the debate issues so far. And I can think there's nobody here that I really like. Nobody of the whole crowd, which is unusual.
There's a question regarding the political campaign that we'll try to get to. But you take a look, the problem with presidential elections is the candidates propose goodies. I mean, free college, free medical, free this, free that. And then, of course, you know, the word free. And nothing sells like the word free. I'm going to give you stuff if you vote for me and you won't have to pay for it. We'll make somebody else pay for it. And that's always popular. But if you take a look at, I don't care if it's Trump down to Ted Cruz or it's down to Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, they tend to oversimplify the real problems that are facing this nation. And unfortunately, the media does a very poor job. They focus more on what I call the blood sport of politics. You know, Ted Cruz said this about Donald Trump. Donald Trump said this about Ted Cruz. Bernie Sanders is now saying this about Hillary. Hillary is saying this about Bernie. And they get into this nonsensical stuff rather than holding the candidates responsible for what the real issues are that this nation is facing. And unfortunately, I think what the gold market is reflecting is this anger and loss of confidence, not only in financial institutions like a central bank or the Fed, but also the loss in confidence in Washington and politicians, which is being reflected in this year's presidential campaign and the anger that many voters feel right now.
There's something that Greg Weldon said earlier on in the program today, too, and that was, he said, this could be a long time in playing out. You know, you and I have marveled at how the central banks have managed to play this game and stretch it further than anyone thought, although one of Congressman Ron Paul's last messages upon leaving Congress is saying there is coming a day of reckoning in the not distant future. And he said, imagine the wailing and gnashing of teeth when that happens. But the real question is, will it be in our lifetimes, or are they going to just be able to stretch this and stretch this? And we'll see.
I always marvel at central banks and government's ability to blame somebody else for problems that they create. And I marvel even more, John, is government creates a problem, and then the solution is always presented to the voters is, well, what we need is more government. And, you know, it's surprising, but they can delay. I mean, we started out with QE1. It was only supposed to last a year, and that was supposed to restart the economy. And then things were going to get up and go. And certainly the economic growth rate coming out of the recession lows of 2009 and going forward for almost 12 months, it looked pretty good. But you got to remember, the Fed was spending $1 trillion. And the government was spending $1 trillion. So it took $2 trillion to bring us out of a recession. And it lasted only a year because QE1 ended in the summer of 2010. And by the fall, the Fed announced QE2. And then we got QE3, or what I call QE4. We had a number of things. And all along the way, as Greg and I talked about, they kept changing the benchmarks. And it was amazing. Well, if we got the unemployment rate down to this, then we're going to start raising. Well, then all of a sudden it became inflation, and they kept changing the benchmarks. And certainly Yellen's speech last week has changed the benchmarks once again. And as Greg and I were talking about, I think the Fed is now hinting at that possibly Fed policy may gradually be reversing and going in the opposite direction, which once again brings us back to the gold market. And what gold is sniffing out here is really the vulnerability of Fed policy or its limitations and the possibility that in the end, what this is going to lead to is a debasement of the currency. And I think that's really what the gold market is telling us, and one of the reasons why we have shifted to a more favorable stance when it comes to gold.
Next question, number three. Over the years, as we have carried out our numerous conversations, you repeatedly stress there are three factors that influence the markets. Number one, technicals. Number two, fundamentals. And number three, politicals. If you had to weight any one of these three factors, which is the one that influences you more in decision making?
You know, I would say right now, and especially coming out of the Great Recession, it's probably been politicals. Because, I mean, if we go back to March of 2009, when the bear market ended in stocks, what happened in the month of March? A couple of things. Number one, the Fed got rid of mark-to-market accounting for banks, so it made it a little harder to short these banks. Secondly, the Fed announced quantitative easing, or QE1. So if you take a look at what we've focused on here talking about this bull market and this economic recovery over the last 7-8 years, John, can you remember a time when we're not talking about the Fed, whether it was QE1, 2, 3, 4, or the taper or the Fed raising rates? And so politics has had a great influence on this economic cycle because we're not operating in free markets right now because we're operating on markets that are heavily manipulated by monetary policy. I mean, when the Fed raises, lowers, or prints money, that has an absolute impact on what happens in the marketplace. And one of the reasons that we were very favorable towards stocks with the Nelly economic stimulus that came out in 2009 with President Obama's stimulus program, where basically the government was going to throw $1 trillion of new spending at the economy, but also the Fed was going to print $1 trillion. And so, you know, stocks were cheap after falling 45%. A lot of things were cheap. Even gold was cheap in 2008 and 2009. So if you take a look at what we focus on, we're not focusing on a lot of what I would say would be the fundamentals. We still follow them. I mean, we take a look at the LEIs. What are the LEIs reflecting? What are they telling us about the economy? We're looking at corporate profits, the labor market. All those things are still fundamentally oriented. But what is influencing many of those factors has been monetary policy. So when the Fed comes out and says something, they're going to do something, look what happens. And this goes back to a series of QE1, QE2, QE3. And I call QE4. And what did we see? We saw the markets take off. I mean, some of the best double-digit returns when you think about it. The S&P is up over several 100% from the bottom of 2009. But look what has happened since then. We began 2013 with the taper talk where the Fed came out and said, you know what? We're going to ease back and we're going to stop printing money. We're going to gradually phase out of that. Well, we saw a swift correction in the market. But then when the Fed said, hey, we're going to do this over a slower period of time, remember 2013, the stock market was up 30%. And as the Fed began to phase out of quantitative easing, so by November of 2014, the Fed was no longer adding liquidity to the market. Look what happened to the stock market. The stock market has had difficulty since the end of 2014 putting in a positive return. Last year was a mixed return. Take a look at where we are this year. We began right from the beginning of the year with a steep downturn in stock prices. And then all of a sudden, we had a rally, which was probably instigated by a shift in central bank policy. With Japan going to negative interest rates, the Fed pulling back on the number of rate hikes, and then also recently with Yellen's speech implying that maybe they may be shifting in the opposite direction, and QE is much more likely in the future than future rate hikes. So this is a market that is heavily influenced by government policy. And one of the problems that we've had with anemic economic growth is we've had terrible, terrible fiscal policy. We raised taxes, and I've never seen an economy respond to higher taxes. It just does not do well. And we've had more taxes, we've had more regulation, we've had the overbearing Obamacare, which, by the way, is another thing that's going to impact a lot of Americans that do not have medical insurance. Because Obamacare, if you're a young person and you don't have a medical policy, the government is going to charge you sort of a tax. And that tax was going to be phased in until 2016, this year. If you are single and you don't have a medical policy, when you file your tax return in April of 2017, you're going to get hit with a $700 fine. That is going to be hitting a lot of young people in 2017, another factor. So we've had very, very poor fiscal policy, which is one reason why we've had the anemic economic growth that we've had. And we're getting even more of it, more regulations. The news stories this week is the Obama administration is coming out with a slew of new regulations that are going to hamper and make it even more difficult for businesses to expand or do business. Heavy regulation and taxation, John, do not bode well for the economy, and the situation is only getting worse, which is one reason why we think the outcome of the election, which we'll get to, has a great bearing on it. And I have to say, I don't see any great choices when it comes to this fall in terms of who we're going to vote for president.
And you notice, Jim, that this recovery has been more influenced probably by politics than anything else. Because remember, right as we went into the problem area, 2007, 2008, right about that point, the whole controversy that Congress dumped on the country about Obamacare just created a huge atmosphere of instability for businesses. And they just froze up. They said, we don't know what's going to happen here, and we're not going to make a move until we do. So right at the time we needed to be creating jobs, the effect was just the opposite.
And, you know, when you have regulation that creates so much uncertainty, whether it's the EPA coming down on the coal industry, the utility industry, all of the environmental restrictions that are coming out today, it's just absolutely amazing. And what businesses and markets like are certainty. And when you create an uncertain environment, and, you know, I don't care if it's monetary policy, John, because right now we've had, how many flip-flops have we had on the Fed over the last 5 or 6 years? Are they or are they not? I mean, all of a sudden, December, they raised rates and they said, hell's bells, we're going to be raising interest rates every quarter. And look how quickly they reverse themselves. What does that do for markets? What does that do for a business when you don't know what interest rates are going to be or what government policy is going to be or even taxation? I can think back when it comes to estate taxes, we were in almost limbo for several years. We didn't know what the estate tax rates were going to be, and that wasn't clarified until 2013. So it made it very difficult for businesses to plan or families to plan when it came to estate planning. So all of this is creating an environment that is becoming more restrictive, more onerous. The regulatory burdens, the tax burdens are getting higher. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. And yet, that policy, John, shows no sign of shifting here, at least in the short term here over the next 12 months. So, you know, as we take a look at the things that influence markets, whether it's the technicals, what are the charts telling us, the fundamentals, or the politicals, we think politicals in this kind of environment are the greater influence in terms of what happens to the economy and the financial markets.
Over the last 4 to 5 years, you have emphasized and recommended dividend paying, usually blue chip stocks, but basically dividend paying stocks. Now that you believe we're likely to roll over into a recession, are you still favoring these stocks? And if not, what do you do with them?
Absolutely. I mean, Dan Wojtropski and I talked about this in the first hour. But John, if I take a look at where interest rates are today, whether you're looking at treasuries or you're looking at, you know, even the corporate bond market. I mean, if I take a look at a 10-year treasury right now, I'm getting a yield of about 1.7%. If I'm looking at a 30-year treasury bond, I'm only getting a yield of 2.5%. I can go into a dividend-paying stock. I don't care if it's a Coca-Cola, a Procter & Gamble, an Exxon, a Cisco, a Microsoft. I can get dividend yields that are 3 and 4%. And unlike that 10-year treasury, which will remain at 1.7%. You buy a 10-year treasury today at 1.7%, you just locked in that 1.7% for the next 10 years. It's not going to change. Every single year, you'll get 1.7%. On the other hand, I can go into a dividend-paying stock and get twice the amount that I would get in a 10-year treasury. And more importantly, I could see that dividend go up each year. So I may be getting maybe 3.5% today, but 10 years from now, I may be getting the equivalent of 7 and 8% because of dividend increases. I would say probably the biggest change has been in the type of dividend stocks that we're looking at now. We're more, I would say, in defensive type stocks like utilities, telecoms, consumer staples, because of what we see as a weakening economy and a possible recession heading into next year. So absolutely do I like dividends. I think for any kind of investor, and especially for those who are thinking about heading into retirement, the only way you're going to make it through retirement is to have dividend paying stocks where you have something that can go up each year. And why would I want to tie up my money, let's say at 1.7% in a treasury? It's even worse if you look at, let's say, shorter term treasury notes where, you know, a 5-year treasury note is 1.1%. I mean, that's below the inflation rate even before we get to paying taxes. So yes, we still like dividend paying stocks. We still have them in our portfolio. I would say the major change is we've shifted the emphasis in terms of the sectors that we're investing in, given our viewpoint that we're heading into a recession. And so when you're heading into a recession, you want to be in those sectors that are least vulnerable to an economic downturn, which is consumer staples or, let's say, healthcare. These are the things that we like, but absolutely, we still like dividend stocks. And that is something I see for the balance of this decade, unless we get a major, major shift in interest rates where they actually become positive, meaning that you're actually getting a rate of return that is above the inflation rate. And we're far from that for the balance of this decade, in my opinion.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Satyajit Das is an internationally respected expert in finance with over 35 years of experience. In 2014, Bloomberg nominated him as one of the 50 most influential financial thinkers in the world. He's worked for Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and the TNT Group, and he has acted as a consultant advising banks, investors, corporations, and central banks around the world. So with that said, let's start off by asking the question, what is so provocative about your new book, Das, and why do you think people need to read it?
I think fundamentally, you have to ask yourself what the problems we face are. And one of the problems was we had too much debt. And we also obviously have a problem in terms of we've promised ourselves entitlements in the future, which are not fully funded. Now, the way we tried to manage this was very simple. We use monetary policy, cut interest rates. We use quantitative easing, and we're now moving to negative interest rates to try to create growth and inflation. And that's failed. And that's failed because the whole world has this gigantic albatross around its neck called its debt, which can't be serviced. Now, the question is, if you look at each of these policies, what they actually mean. Now, I don't think the policies followed by the central banks initially were that silly because it bought time. But the point is, during that time, you needed to do certain things, which is find out plans to bring back the debt levels, find back plans to wind back entitlements, but nobody really did any of that. We just basically assumed the problem was fixed. And to some extent, the fact that the stock market went up became a sort of symbol of the fact that things were better when the real economy had not recovered. And now what we're seeing is this rather bizarre process of people switching back to fiscal policy. And there's a very famous saying by Winston Churchill, which is, no matter how beautiful the strategy, it's occasionally useful to look at the results.
Well, now you and your staff talk a lot about bonds, but you know, here we talk about interest rates rising. They've only gone up a skunch here, and whether or not the Fed does the rest remains to be seen. Isn't there a risk that you could lose money by investing in bonds now?
One of the things that we like about bonds is we use individual bonds versus a bond fund. When you're in a bond fund, absolutely, if interest rates go up, as They did in 2013 when you had 10-year treasury go from 1.6% to 3%. You know, investors in bond funds lost high single digits and double digits. We've seen, for example, last fall when credit spreads began to widen between corporate debt and, let's say, sovereign debt, you know, junk bond spreads widened tremendously and people lost money in junk bond funds. So, you know, we like bonds, John, but we like individual bonds. And right now, because we expect as the economy weakens and eventually heads into a recession, we believe that you're going to see a rise in corporate bond rates. And that's because as the economy weakens, the risk in the credit markets heightens. And so investors begin demanding higher interest rates. And that's certainly what we saw last fall in the corporate bond markets as spreads widen. And we think that will happen again. So, you know, we're staying in the 1 to 2 year range when it comes to bonds, because we think as those bonds roll over, we'll be getting a higher interest rates. The bonds that we bought a little over a year ago that are maturing when we were getting between 2.5% and 3%, now we're getting between 3% and 4%. And so if I was to, let's say, buy a 1 year bond that gives me 3% or 4% and interest rates go up even more, I have less risk owning a short-term bond. They just don't fluctuate that much, is because the maturity is so short. And so in answer to your question, when you own individual bonds and you keep them short-term, there's less of a risk of losing money because you hold the bond for maturity. Let's say I buy it today, and let's say I buy a 2-year bond. In the short term, that bond could lose a couple percent if interest rates go higher. But if I hold that bond, I'm going to get my interest rate as promised in the bond at the time I bought it. And that interest rate will hold true until the bond matures, at which time I'll get my money back. So there's less of a risk of a loss. The only real loss that you have in owning individual bonds are credit risk, which means that, for example, the company or the bond that you buy could default on their payments. And that's why you have to do a lot of credit analysis on what you're buying and know the financial strength of the company, because you're hoping, you know, you're going to hold that bond and you expect to be paid off.
Well, as we've been mentioning here, this year is a presidential election year. If we take some of the leading candidates, what is your view of their views on economics?
Well, I would say of anybody that understands the economy, it would probably be Donald Trump more than any others, although his anti-trade policies are somewhat worrisome to me. It was amazing because there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today that the pace of globalization has been declining over the last couple of years. So once again, here's somebody that is reacting to something that I don't believe is the issue that is presented. But John, I would have to say in this year's presidential election, I'm greatly disappointed in what the choices are going to be. You have one candidate that has integrity issues and truthful issues, and that concerns me because, you know, when you vote for a president, you want that president to be honest with you and tell you the truth. And even sometimes, as unpopular as that truth may be, you have another candidate that is basically clueless. And I'm talking about Bernie Sanders here. I mean, the guy has no idea how a economy works. And the fact that, you know, he's promising free college, which sounds pretty good if you're a millennial and you're racking up high student loans, and free medical care, free Medicare, all this stuff being free. You know, we did a show on this a couple months ago where it was right after the government's fiscal budget came out. The government's fiscal year ends in September, and it was right around November that we got the fiscal numbers for the 2015 government fiscal year. And John, you look at the numbers and you look at where the government spends money. You've got 70% of the government's money is going to interest on the debt, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. 20% goes to defense. So now you're at 90%. You've got basically 10% is left over, and that goes for paying for running the government, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the courts, Congress, all the different government agencies. Where in the heck is all this money going to come from? You know, where are you going to get the money to spend $20 to $30 trillion of new spending programs for college free for everybody, medical free for everybody? We simply don't have the money, and we simply don't have the money to pay for what we're offering right now, which is, as many, I'm sure, those of you listening to this program who are on Medicare have seen how the government covers less and less. If you're in a drug program on Medicare, they're forcing you into generics. And look at all the reneging that the government has had, whether it's Social Security benefits. I mean, what they just did last November to women in Social Security. And so you look at these candidates promising things, and then the idea that, you know, Trump is going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. I mean, how realistic is that? Or you're going to send 12 million illegal that are here now, you're going to send them back over the border? How realistic is that? We wouldn't have the manpower to even conduct and do that. So you hear a lot of these statements that are very popular with the public. And the public falls in and says, oh, yeah, I like that. Boy, that appeals to me. And John, it's just so unrealistic. And this is the problem. And I think this stems right back to the media, that the media isn't asking the candidates the right questions, the real issues. Why aren't they asking Bernie Sanders why your numbers don't add up and where are you going to get the money to pay for all this stuff? Or a candidate's integrity in terms of truthfulness? Or, you know, talking to somebody like Donald Trump in terms of what he wants to do, you know, whether build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, and some of his things like, okay, I'm going to make America great again. But you know what, Donald, tell me how you're going to do that. Give me some detail here. Give me some policy that's concrete and lays out your vision of how you're going to fix things. I think he has a better handle in terms of how economy runs than, let's say, the other politicians. But once again, you've got to talk about something that is specific here. And unfortunately, John, the public is buying into the free stuff. And, you know, anybody that had some credibility, anybody that was very successful as a governor, especially on the Republican side, were quickly dissed in this cycle. So it's really amazing. But I don't see anything that's really promising. It's kind of like pick your poison here. It's a sad state of affairs in terms of these are what our choices are boiling down to.
Well, other than rattlesnakes sneaking in when you didn't notice it, what are things that bother you at night?
You know, one of the things that really bother me is, you know, a number of trends that I see emerging in this country. And one of them is a growing intolerance for opposing views. You know, one of the things that we've always tried to pride ourselves here on the Financial Sense NewsHour is to have different viewpoints on the air, whether it's on the market, commodities, economics, didn't matter. Even our technicians have people that are bearish, have people that are bullish, so that you, the listener, can listen to both sides, both arguments, and draw your own conclusions. You're seeing it on college campuses, John, where surprisingly, college campuses should be the bastion of free thought. Instead, you're seeing a closed-mindedness and an intolerance for opposing views to the point of protest.
Well, actually wanting to get rid of professors who dissent. And you have to remember that in the 60s, the new progressive movement that came in made its debut on the background of demanding free speech, regardless of how offensive it was. And it seems to have come 50 years later. We flipped that over now and it's gone the other way. But I'm following a case at Marquette University and there's a bunch of other stuff. It just sort of rolls in whereby professors who take different positions on different issues, all of a sudden there'll be this protest, they demand that they be fired, all of that type of nonsense. You know, last time we saw that was the brown shirts in Germany just before Hitler's rise.
Not only that, but it's also too that free market economics and the Constitution are no longer taught in our public school system. I mean, I remember in the 90s, my son coming into my study one night, and he said, Dad, I didn't realize that, you know, lowering taxes caused a recession. I looked at him and I go, what? And basically, I looked at his economic textbook, and there was a section in there that in 1981, when Reagan lowered income taxes, according to this economic textbook, it basically reduced the amount of revenues the government could have to stimulate the economy, and therefore it was a recession. Well, you know what? The economy was already in a recession when Reagan lowered income taxes. But this is the kind of nonsense and garbage that's being taught in school. You know, John, there's probably a handful of colleges in this country where, let's say, Austrian economics is taught. In fact, if you were to believe in Austrian economics, and let's say you had got your degree in economics, it's very unlikely you could get a job at a public university teaching Austrian economics. They would throw you out. So we're not teaching people how a free market works and why capitalism has been the greatest economic philosophy in terms of prosperity ever invented by man in recorded history. So we're not teaching that. The other thing that bothers me, too, is what is happening as a result of U.S. withdrawal and foreign policy. I mean, you just look at any place you want to look at, from Syria to Lebanon to Egypt to Afghanistan to Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Libya. I mean, just take a look at the events that we've seen in not only Paris recently, but also Belgium. I mean, just take a look at the kind of things. And here in the United States, where we're almost having some kind of form of terrorist activity almost on a monthly basis. And there seems to be this growing uneasiness, you know, in terms of safety as a result of what has happened here in the last 7 or 8 years. So, you know, these are the kind of things that keep me up at night, and I worry about it because, you know, free markets, free speech, the right to bear arms, these are important things that our founding fathers gave to us in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution. There seems to be an easiness of which to trample those and take those rights away. And we've become less free. We did a piece on this show of 10 things you're going to do without in the next 10 years, everything from landlines and things like that. But one of them is the loss of privacy. I don't know if it's like where you live, John, but you're driving on major streets now. There's cameras everywhere. I mean, just take a look at, for example, the bombers in the Belgium tragedy. They just caught, I guess, that third person today due to cameras. So everywhere you walk, you're on camera, whether you're sitting in your car at a stoplight, walking on a sidewalk, in a public area, walking into a shopping mall. We're losing our privacy, and especially the government's ability to tap into it. And of course, this was brought up, what was it, John, a couple of years ago when it came out that the NSA is building a huge, huge facility. What is it, in Utah? Literally billions of dollars of supercomputers in storage. You kind of wonder, what do they plan on doing with that?
Listening to everybody and documenting phone calls. That's what they're going to do, despite all of the protest and the hoo-ha, and it'll all be buried under national security secrecy types of things. And we already know that, you know, there's enough leakage that's occurred that they're constructing what are called parallel evidence trails. And what that means is, well, you couldn't use the evidence that the NSA gets, but what they do is to they leak information to other law enforcement to tell them where to look for stuff. And then they construct that evidence trail based on info from the NSA. And of course, that's never brought up when the cases go to court. This is the kind of mischief that we have going on right now. So that's one of the problems. Anyway, let's go to the next question here. Despite the lowest interest rates in decades, economic growth has been absolutely anemic. Are we approaching the end of government intervention and its ability to stimulate the economy, or do they have some more cards to play?
You know, this was an interesting question that I think Greg Weldon and I talked about in the first hour. And just as Greg has been amazed, so have I, in terms of the government's ability. I mean, you know, when they did QE1, and what I found rather fascinating when they did QE1, John, was how the economic times have changed. Because when I got in this business at the end of the 70s, we used to call them the M&Ms. We watched monetary growth, M1, M2, M3. We used to get the figures out every Thursday, and every time those monetary aggregates began to grow, you would see interest rates rise, the inflation numbers go up, and basically, the Arthur Burns Fed was basically monetizing much of the government's debt. And here we are, you know, 2009, the Fed comes out and says, we're going to print $1.2 trillion. And how perceptions have changed. And basically, the financial markets are saying, hey, we love this, because if you're printing all this kind of money, that means it's going to inflate asset values, which means if we invest in stocks or commodities or whatever it is that's inflating, we're going to make a lot of money. Where in the 70s, we would look at that askance and say, wait a minute, this is inflationary. This is going to be bad for the economy. This isn't good. But today, we've got a complete change of thinking. So in answer to, you know, this question, are they out of bullets yet? I don't think so. And you really have to study a number of Fed papers that were written probably towards the end of the 1990s in terms of interest rates zero bound. Bernanke wrote a paper, and basically, that was his famous helicopter speech, where the government can always create inflation if it wants. It's just a question of maintaining its credibility. And so, you know, are they done yet? I don't think so. But the fact is that they are resorting to more and more different avenues to make things go, tells you just how we are approaching that end game. Because, you know, for what, 50, 60 years, we had an economic cycle that was pretty predictable. It was almost textbook. You know, the economy began to overheat. Inflation would heat up as a result of excess money and credit. The Fed would raise interest rates until they broke something, usually the economy and the markets. Then, as the economy headed into a recession, the Fed would respond by lowering interest rates, which would eventually cause credit to expand and the economic recovery would begin. And this is the way things worked for 50, 60 years. Well, if you take a look at coming out of the tech cycle, when Greenspan, when he took over in 1987, anytime there was a crisis, the stock market crash in 1987, the Gulf War and the recession of 91, and S&L crisis, the peso crisis in 94, Asia crisis in 97, long-term capital management and Russia debt default in 1998, Y2K scare in 1999, the recession of 2001, there was always a large monetary response. But if you look at what happened after 2001, Greenspan had to bring interest rates down, the Fed funds rate down to the lowest level that we had seen in over half a century, down to 1%. And even when the Fed began to raise interest rates in 2004, they did so in incremental steps, a quarter of a point at a time. It took them 3 years to get up to a little over a 5% federal funds rate. Then look what happened afterwards. Bernanke brought interest rates down to a quarter of a point. And look how long it has taken the Fed from the announcement of taper in May of 2013 to the first rate hike in December of 2015. So is the Fed out of bullets? I don't think so. There are a number of things they can do. One would be negative interest rates, as Japan has done. That's something they've looked at. Monetizing other assets is another thing that would happen. And also, I think you could see very well in the future if we head into an economic downturn, because Congress will have to recognize that the Fed is pretty much run out of bullets, is you would see probably a major fiscal stimulus to the economy that would be simply monetized by the Fed printing even more amounts of money. And as we referred to earlier in this program, one of the backdrops for gold being in a favorable environment is this monetary endgame that we're approaching. Now, how long can this play out? It could play out for several years and maybe even to the balance of the rest of the decade. But John, they're not running out of bullets yet. They still have further number of things that they can do. And, you know, they may be even working on stuff right now that we haven't even heard of yet that they're looking at. So that's why I pay a lot of attention to a lot of those economic studies that were done in the latter part of the 90s that were done by the Federal Reserve on some of these papers about interest rates when you're in the zero bound, including Bernanke's helicopter speech. I mean, essentially, the government could do that. They could come out and say, we're going to give you a massive tax cut, and the Fed's just simply going to monetize the money to pay for it.
Well, ironically, that was the next question here, is what is the ultimate end game for central banks' attempts to revitalize the economy? It's apparent that things really aren't working right now, despite low interest rates. Is there ever that moment of judgment in, you know, Ron Paul's been warning about it ever since, well, he's been warning about it all the time he's been in Congress and on the Finance Committee in the House, but he's still saying that it is coming and we're going to pay a heavy price for it.
You know, I think on the end game, the way they get rid of the deflationary problems and the debt problem is go to a reset. And what they could do is exactly what Roosevelt did in his first week of office, let's say in 1933, and that's revalue the currency against gold. And as Jim Rickards talked about in my interview with him last week, the monetary reset for gold would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 an ounce. And that is what I think is ultimately going to be the end game, is we will go through a major devaluation of the currency. We'll move more towards a global central bank. We'll move more towards a global currency. Somehow that currency, I think, is going to have to be tied to gold, because the very reason of the devaluation would shake public confidence in any kind of currency. And that would just bring the economy to a standstill. So I think the end game, John, is to go for a reset. I mean, the government has $20 trillion of debt. That debt will be growing at close to $600 to $800 billion a year. And one of the problems that the Fed has had, it's been very difficult, is we have not been able to get the inflation rate in the economy to grow at a faster rate than debt accumulation. So for a financial repression to work, as it did, let's say, following World War II, you have to have inflation and economic growth, or at least nominal economic growth, at a faster rate than the rate of which you're taking on debt. And they've been unable to achieve that, despite the numerous quantitative easings and keeping interest rates at close to zero. So the monetary endgame, in my opinion, is going to be a devaluation of the currency. And that's going to be devastating for a lot of people on fixed income, a lot of people on fixed investments, because it'll be suddenly, it will be not something that you'll have a lot of time to prepare. So you better learn how to read the economic tea leaves. And this reminds me of when I first got in the business, John. It's hard to believe that rates were as high as they were, but, you know, treasuries were 15%. You could have got 18% in a money market fund, 15% at a bank CD. And I had moved to San Diego in 1982. And one of the popular things that was going on with seniors here is they were putting money in Mexican banks because you could get 25 to 30% interest rates. Now imagine, folks, if you had, let's say, a $100,000 CD at a bank and you were getting paid 30%. I mean, $30,000 on a $100,000 investment. The problem was Mexico got a new president. And when he assumed office overnight, he devalued the currency by 50%. So all those seniors that had $100,000 in bank deposits, when they brought them back to the U.S., those bank deposits were only worth $50,000. And it's the same thing that happened to many savers in this country in 1933 when Roosevelt devalued the currency by 60%. So the ultimate end game, John, is going to be a complete debt reset. And I think they will do that. And they're going to do that with a devaluation of the currency. That's ultimately, when you take a look at these major deflationary episodes, that has been the ultimate remedy. And that's why, going back to something that Bernanke said in one of his famous speeches about helicopter money, the government can always, if it wants to, create inflation. It's just a matter of credibility. And given the right circumstances, that's ultimately what they're going to end up doing.
Well, I think one thing, Jim, that's going to become easier to deal with is once we get through the various parties' conventions and you really know who the final candidates are, then we can focus more in on what they believe or what their ideas are economically and or politically that would affect free enterprise and the markets and everything else like that. So I think that's going to be favorable in the future. Anything else we should look for as we close out the program today?
Well, it's going to be interesting. Here we are in April, so the next couple of weeks we have a Fed meeting coming up in April, and nobody expects them to raise interest rates. If anything, clarification, there won't be a press conference. But John, we're right entering into first quarter earnings season, so we're going to be paying attention to what companies are saying on earnings, who meet, who missed, what companies are saying about the quarters ahead. So we're going to be entering into corporate earnings season, so expect a little bit more volatility in the markets. And of course, a Fed meeting. All that coming up in the month ahead. So lots of stuff to talk about. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.